The Subcommittee on Elections will come to order. Senator Hayden moves the minutes in the packet from Thursday, February 19th. No, Senator Hayden, we appreciate that you're here. Is there any discussion?
I'm just wondering, has he sufficiently read them and memorized them?
They were sent out ahead of time, I believe, so I'm sure he's reviewed them. So all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. Senator Carlson, you have two bills before us today. Would you like to do the Senate File 206 first, the voting registration age modification bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I would like to do 206 first.
Senator Carlson, to your bill.
Madam Chair, Senate File 206 is a voter registration age modification. I do have an amendment, so I don't know exactly when you would like to hear that amendment. It doesn't make substantial changes to it.
Senator Carlson, this is the first hearing that this bill has had, so we can move the – is it the A3 amendment?
Yes, it is an author's amendment.
We will move the Senator Hayden moves, or I'm sorry, Senator Carlson, you move the A3 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Senator Carlson, to your amendment or the bill, I should say.
Well, first, maybe I will make a couple of comments about the amendment. The amendment makes it crystal clear that this is a pre-registration instead of a registration. And that is the essence of the bill, is to allow younger folks to pre-register, similar to what we already have for 17-year-olds. Today, 17-year-olds can pre-register if they will be 18 by the election. And what we're trying to do is promote civic engagement and allow younger people to pre-register while they're in high school and while they may be in classes that are civics-oriented classes or have things to that they're pursuing on being more civically involved. I think probably one of the best illustrations of that is the last couple of days we've had a lot of students coming in and coming to my office and asking about bills. And the nice thing about it is we're going to be turning our government over to these people, and the sooner that they understand how the government works, how they can get their thoughts put into bills, and where they need to go to get their thoughts put into the bills and to get ready to run this state, the better off we're going to be. The original bill was entered into the process at the Youth in Government program, and it was passed there almost unanimously on the floor of the Youth in Government Senate. They ran out of time to get it passed by their youth and government legislature. But what it did is it had so much support that it was brought forward by a constituent of mine that you'll hear testify soon. Now, what this bill does is it allows young people to apply for registration, and their name will be put into a database that is similar to what the 17-year-olds previously were able to do. And it will allow them to be registered at the time when they're appropriately the appropriate age to vote in the next election. Now, with me, I have Secretary of State Steve Simon and two other student testifiers. And I'm going to see if there's Secretary Simon would join me at the table here and describe his perception of the bill and answer some questions that he might be able to give the best answers for.
Secretary Simon, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate it. Thank you, members, as well. I know you're going to hear from some other testifiers, but to me, this bill is really about getting good habits started early. This, as Senator Carlson said, really extends what we have already on the books, but it really enables students in high school to, at an earlier time, get civically engaged and active and energized. And I think you'll see today there's no shortage of energy and activity and excitement among young people. I will tell you that this first came to me and first came onto my radar screen from students, from young people, not from any organized interest or party or ideological group, from actual independent students who just thought this was a good idea, either through the Youth in Government program or others, and were excited about it, excited about the fact that 22 other states already do this in some form. And by the way, I think it's important to note that the states that already have something like this among the 22 are stereotypically blue states, like Hawaii, and stereotypically red states, like Florida. And there's some great data and some great studies out there about the actual effects after the law has passed. Because it's one thing to talk theoretically about what would happen if young people had this opportunity to get engaged. It's another to look at what the numbers actually say. And there are studies that our office is happy to forward to members if they care to see them. Some of them are quite lengthy, but we're happy to forward you the links and the information. And these studies demonstrate that there is an uptick in civic engagement of anywhere from 8 to 13%. An uptick from 8 to 13% in the percentage of those who participate in the process based on whether they were pre-registered or not. And that seems to make some common sense because, like any habit, if you get it started early, it's likely to remain a habit. And that's something that I think we want to do. So I think there are other testifiers that you're going to want to hear from, but our office certainly supports this bill. It's youth-led. It's youth-driven. We just want to make sure they can get across the finish line. It's a bipartisan bill here in the legislature, in the House. It's got a Republican chief author, Representative Dean Erdahl. And so thank you all for your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Is it Eileen Campbell?
Yes.
Welcome to the committee. If you could just please say your name first, and then you can give us your testimony.
Okay. Hello, my name is Eileen Campbell, and I'm 15 years old. I'm in ninth grade at Southfield Middle School in Edina, and I'm here to tell you why I want voter pre-registration. There are five main reasons why I believe this is important. The first reason is motivation. At many schools, students between the ages of 15 and 17 have just taken U.S. government and are at that time more motivated to register to vote. Voter pre-registration can take advantage of that motivation and push you to commit to voting when you're 18. The second reason is habit. The younger you start something, the more likely it is to become a life habit. Voter pre-registration could create that lifelong habit of voting. The third reason is trust. If people have a say in their government and who represents them, they are more likely to trust the government. The fourth is to increase the diversity of those who vote. If the bill passes, voter pre-registration could be done at high schools and reach those currently in underrepresented communities. The fifth and final reason includes all the others. Voter pre-registration will increase the voter turnout, which creates a healthier democracy. Statistics show that in the states that currently have voter pre-registration, they also have a 13% higher voter turnout rate. I've told you some of the reasons why I support this bill, and I'm going to tell you about some of my experiences. Recently, I went door knocking in lower income communities and tried to get pledges to vote. I knocked on one door and came across a man who was against voting and the government in every way imaginable. He told us he most definitely won't be voting in the coming election because of a number of reasons. Two reasons stood out to me. The first being that he knew no one who would be voting this coming election. The second is that he didn't trust legislators. When I was younger, I remember going to my mom to her polling location and filling out the kid ballots. Since I was so young and really only knew who was running for president, but after my mom was done with her ballot, I would make her stand over my shoulder and explain who she was voting for and why she was voting for them. Going to kid voting inspired me to vote when I turned 18. If the man I met while door knocking started voting when he was young, perhaps he would be more likely to vote now, maybe even convince his friends to vote too. Kid voting with my mom and taking U.S. government this year has increased my interest to vote. I know that if this bill passed, my teachers would be encouraging us to register. I would definitely be telling my friends to register as soon as possible. My kid voting and classes this year have and the people I've met while door knocking have taught me the importance of voting. I want people to vote, and pre-registration will motivate people to vote. For all these reasons, and as a future voter, I ask you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Campbell.
Are there any questions?
I don't think so. Thank you very much for your testimony. And is it Daniel Thomas Cummins?
Correct.
Welcome to the committee. If you could also please state your name for the tape, please.
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Dan Thomas Cummins, and I am an interested student as well as a constituent of Senator Carlson's. I'm also the one who originally came to him with the idea for Senate File 206, and I drafted some of the original language that was sent to the revisor's office. And I'd like to thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing this bill to come before the committee, and I'd also like to thank Senator Carlson, Secretary Simon, and really too many other people to list for all their hard work in making this idea for a bill a reality. So, members, I'm proud to bring this bill to you today. This bill would allow 16-year-olds to pre-register to vote with the understanding that they will not be able to eligible to vote until they are 18. First, I'd like to point out how bipartisan this proposal is. In case the bill's list of authors was not evidence enough for this, in 2008, a similar bill unanimously passed a Republican-controlled Florida House of Representatives and passed a Republican-controlled Senate 36-2. Republican Governor Charlie Crist signed the bill into law. In 2009, the North Carolina General Assembly passed this measure in the House 107-6 and the Senate 32-3. I should also point out that the exact margin of the Youth in Government Senate that passed it was 42-2. So that was kind of a victory for me, I'd say. I know Minnesotans are eager to see good faith, constructive cooperation with our newly divided legislature, and if it is passed, I see this bill as serving as an example of how different political parties can come together and provide constructive criticism when necessary in order to create the best common sense policy for Minnesota. And that's exactly why I see this policy as, is common sense. I wrote the bill to increase access to the democratic process by reducing ambiguity and increasing convenience. Minnesota has a proud history of being a high voter turnout state, but unfortunately, voter turnout fell more sharply than usual during the last election. And based on experiences I have had in dealing with my peers and discussing political issues, I feel this is indicative of a growing trend among the younger population, who has lived a significant portion of their lives under a do-nothing Congress, and therefore are feeling generally apathetic about the political process. Madam Chair and members, I feel that unless we do something now to remedy this apathy, Minnesota has little to look forward to when it comes to maintaining its voter turnout and having a truly representative government. This bill, by allowing students to pre-register at 16, would help to foster a healthy interest in politics and a strong respect for voting. Studies show that young people who register do turn out to vote by and large. Further studies show that the tendency to vote forms a habit which, if properly fostered at a young age, will continue throughout a person's life. Therefore, by allowing young people to pre-register, we are affording them the opportunity to experience the feeling of investing their voice in the direction of their city or town, their county, their state, and their country. Furthermore, by allowing them to experience this feeling an entire election cycle before they're eligible to vote, they'll be more likely to get involved with civics by paying attention to how their elected officials handle important issues, meeting with their representatives, or even doing what I'm doing right now, participating directly in government. Being involved in these different ways will not only make them more informed voter, but also make them a more consistent voter who knows well the impact of their vote. The current law, which allows 17-year-olds to register to vote if they're 18 by the next election, has proven to be ambiguous. I have personal experience with this. I am 18, and I registered to vote on Labor Day 2013 when I was still 17. I assumed that because I'd be 18 by the 2014 election, I should be fine registering. I neglected to remember that we had a school board election that year. When I tried to register my political science class, the vast majority of the class was concerned that their registrations wouldn't go through because of that election. Even my political science teacher was confused about the process. Now, if we set the registration age at 16, we provide students with a clear time at which they can register without fear that they'll be rejected because of some ambiguous and amorphous condition, which brings me to another reason this bill should pass. It provides uniformity. Like in my experience, current law dictates that someone's eligibility to register can depend on where they live. Because my classmates and I lived in 196, some of us are worried that the school board election would prohibit them from registering. The fact that someone in School District A who was born on the same day as someone in School District B may not be eligible solely because their school district happens to have an election that year speaks volumes about this problem. If we can provide a clear definition of when someone can register and when they can vote, we can help ensure the integrity in our elections. There are a few different ways we can ensure we can engage students to pre-register. Last year, I graduated from Egan High School, where political science and AP government are both senior courses. So everyone in that class would presumably be over 16 years old. As the class is discussing the importance of participating in the democratic process and deciding who represents them and speaks for them in government, the teacher could hand out registration forms. The school could have forms available in the office. In fact, a 2009 study from George Mason University analyzed Florida and Hawaii's pre-registration laws and found that certain implementation methods contributed most to increased voter registration. These included having registration forms available in public schools and other public venues. Let's also look at how the driver's license application could be used in order to register to vote. As I'm sure many of you are aware, current law allows citizens who are eligible to vote or will be eligible to vote by the next election day to check the box on the right side of the form that registers them to vote using the information they provided. At the same time that a 16-year-old goes to get their driver's license, a rite of passage for many of that age, this bill would allow them to check that box and fulfill two rites of passage at the same time. These ad conveniences are some of the reasons why Secretary of State Simon is so excited about this bill. And we've had many conversations on the issue, and every time we talk about this idea, he recites the same refrain: it just makes sense. Madam Chair and members, I hope you'll agree with me that it just makes sense that 16-year-olds should be able to pre-register a vote. It just makes sense there should be a firm time at which young people know if they're eligible to pre-register to vote. It just makes sense that using a driver's license application to register should be open to anyone who can apply for a driver's license. And it just makes sense that we should be doing everything we can to ensure our state's future as a strong participatory democracy. I hope you will support Senate File 206. Thank you for allowing me to testify today, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have to the best of my abilities.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas Cummings. Senator Hayden.
Senator Carlson, did you say Mr. Thomas Cummings is your constituent?
Yes, he is.
I think he's the person that's probably going to take your place.
Madam Chair, Senator Hayden, that would be a pleasure.
Thank you for your testimony. Jeremy Schrader.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I thank you very much for your time. My name is Jeremy Schrader. I'm the Executive Director of Common Cause Minnesota, a citizen advocacy group committed to honest, open, and accountable government, as well as ensuring that every voice in every community is heard throughout throughout Minnesota. I'm here today to support Senate File 206, a bill that would help prepare our youth for a lifetime of voting. Common Cause supports this legislation because it helps our lagging youth voting rates with little or no cost, and that voting is so essential to our democracy that we must do everything possible to engage all communities in Minnesota. I'm going to skip over most of my testimony because it's been covered much, much better by those that have already testified, but do want to back up some of the things I've said with 2 points specifically. We've heard a lot of talk about how this has been passed in both red and blue states. And the studies actually go a little bit deeper that the Secretary had already kind of hinted at. And for me, it was fascinating that while youth from 18 to 25 do generally tend to vote Democrat, the number of unregistered voters are more likely to be Republican. So this bill, I think that should explain a little bit more of why both sides see this as a win. For me, I found that fascinating, but I am one of those policy nerds. The second part was really just to hear about how this bill will actually fix the problem. Heard it hinted out that this really starts a history of voting. It starts a lifetime commitment to kind of being civically involved. What the numbers kind of bear out is that not only do people that are more registered are more likely to vote, but youth specifically, when they are registered, are more likely to vote, even more so than their older colleagues. So this bill goes directly to that. And another aspect of this bill that also helps, it's not just youth in general, but specifically communities of color are also increased turnout in voting. So in many ways, it's hard to see how this is a bad move. Like, this is very smart policy and is something that Minnesota should adopt immediately. It's, again, Senate File 206 is a simple measure to get youth more civically involved in civic life. And we need to show the next generation of citizens and leaders that we value their involvement, their voice, and their contributions to Minnesota by making this common sense reform. Thank you, and I'll take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Schrader. Are there any questions? Is there anybody else in the audience who wishes to testify either in support or in opposition to Senate File 206? Senator Carlson, do you have anything else to add?
Yes, Madam Chair. voting is a proud moment for young people. It's a proud moment for all of us. My mother just recently passed away at 98. Voting was a very proud moment for her each time it happened. She never missed a vote. She, in later years, she couldn't see very well. She was not physically able to get to the polls, but she told me exactly when she was going to vote absentee. That was a very proud moment for her. And I think what we're seeing is that these young people, and I think you picked up on the enthusiasm here, these young people really want to become involved. And I think they've had that opportunity to become involved in their schools, and I think that this is something that will be a life habit for them. And I guess another perspective on it is I think we all remember those pictures of the folks in Iraq. When they were able to vote, they held up their thumbs because that was how they did their documentation of when they voted. They stuck their thumbs in an inkwell, and they held up that thumb. And they were very proud of that. And so I think that voting is a very pride-related activity, and I think us trying to make sure that young people have realized the profound importance of voting is something that's good for all of us, and I think that's one of the reasons why I've enthusiastically supported this bill. So thank you, Madam Chair. And if there's any questions, I'll take the questions.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And while I really appreciate, I think our motivations and our intentions here are honorable in that regard, no matter what. So I want to be sure and recognize that. However, last year in the election, turnout was extremely down, and amongst our youth as well, and we have pre-registration for 17-year-olds. And so the statistics and the facts don't show necessarily that kind of correlation. However, what is an extremely strong correlation, in which I promoted very strongly and was even testified to today by, I believe, Ms. Campbell, and that is the personal context. In other words, a young person going to the polling place on election day and actually going through the process with their parents. Filling out a form is so separated from the voting experience. You've got a year and a half that I don't see this. Now, the practice, and I've always encouraged that, to practice going through the process, but in fact of it relating directly to an increased voter turnout, I have my concerns in that regard, and I think we would be better off using our resources here to encourage. We used to have a program called Kids Voting. They mimicked, and yet they actually in the schools and worked with young people in conducting and registering and going through all that, because it gave them a much stronger connection than this kind of a proposal. So I have, I think that the questions I have in regards to, I always find it's interesting, they could be done at little to no cost, and then we get the fiscal note, and that isn't always quite such the case. I've heard different conflicts about that, so I have some concerns about that. But I want you to know I don't question the motives or the motivations, but the reality of what actually translates into a higher voter turnout, I have found, is not produced by just pre-registering.
Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, in our information here, it does say that there is the American Journal of Political Science, that it does say that the voter turnout is 13% higher. Now, I can't personally verify that, but I think the earlier that we get involved in the civic process, the better. And personally, I am old enough to remember when you didn't vote until you were 21. That was changed many years ago. And I think what we are going to be turning our government over to young people. And I think it is important for having our civic engagement. That's been one of the criticisms of the younger generations, is that they're just not civically involved. And I think that's the reason for that is our fault. It's our fault that they're not getting involved. And I do remember what you were talking about to without disclosing too much about my age, I remember the Kennedy-Nixon fight and how our entire school was involved in that. And we had debates. We had campaigning. We had the literature. We published everything. It was quite a debate, and our school was very involved in that. And I think you're right. We're not seeing quite as much involvement as we did back then. And I think this might have some, some motivation to return to some of those days where we actually get the young people involved before they have to go to the polls and make that decision.
Well, just to follow up, Madam
Senator
Chair.
Kiffmeyer.
Yeah. Whenever I see these studies, and again, seeing this just now, there's a variation between gubernatorial election year, presidential year. So you have variations, the heat of the contest. So statistics often don't recognize the context by which they are collected. So I'm always a bit leery for that reason of any of these kind of statistics, especially when they're presented in the context of something that they, as they say, can find a statistic for every side of the question in the same study. So that's all. I just wanted to make sure that we added that context to any of this kind of a study quote.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Carlson, first off, I appreciate your goal. I think the involvement is real important. I do take issue, though, with your statement that the earlier the better, because that would mean we get them at 10 years old, 5 years old. I mean, that's ridiculous, of course. And so my question is, why 16? And just looking at the 8 kids that I had, I got them all involved when they were ready, because at some point, even 17, they weren't that interested. And in my household, I expected them to be interested, but they just weren't. And eventually they found that, but it really was 17, 18 years old that they started to. I think they all voted when they turned 18. So I don't really see the reason for this. So maybe the question is, why 16?
Senator Carlson.
I guess probably the best answer I can give is yes, I think some young people are probably not interested in being engaged in politics or in the public issues. But I also do think that when you do have young people, and I don't mean 5 years old, I mean when you can actually make an intellectual decision in issues, that's what's important. And I think 16-year-olds, in my case, it was 15 when we had our driver's license. I think a driver's license is pretty important milestone, and it's a very big responsibility to be able to drive a car. And I think voting is, it's not the same, but it also gives you a little bit of an analogous situation with when a person is ready for a little bit more of responsibility. Some people are not ready to drive. They're not ready to drive when they're 21, maybe some people when they're 40. But the fact is that those that are interested will do it. Those that are where their peers are able to get involved and get registered, they will become registered. Also, we have activist organizations, for instance, like the Boy Scouts, that have said that they will be involved in registering people. And I think that will that'll benefit us all.
Senator Carlson, I'd also like to or Senator Hall, I don't think you are in the room, but an earlier testifier also noted that it's about when you're 16 years old that you take American civics or American government in mm-hmm. in high school. And so sometimes that may be students' first exposure or more in-depth exposure to how our political process works. So having it at 16 seems to be a natural progression with that. As with Senator Carlson said, right now, when you get your driver's license, there's a form that you can check if you're 17 or older that you can register to vote at the same time. This would move that down so that you could do it when you're when a lot of people are getting their driver's license, which is when they're 16. And then their registration would be pending until they turn 18. So, you know, it's not telling people they have to vote. I think that the real nice thing about this legislation is it's registering students or registering young people so that they're thinking more that way, that when they turn 18, they will be registered and it will be one less hurdle they'll have to jump through to actually cast a ballot when they're eligible, my perspective. But Mr. Thomas Cummings, did you want to add something? Oh,
yeah.
I'm sorry, just a minute. Senator Hayden had...
No, Madam Chair, you read my mind. I know that Senator Hall wasn't in the room when Ms. Campbell had testified that in her great testimony that that was one of the motivations because of their interactions with the American government class at about the same time. And so I won't reiterate, but that's exactly what I was going to say when we were listening to the testimony when Senator Hall wasn't in the room.
Mr. Thomas Cummings.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to respond to a few of the points that have been made, as far as the earlier the better goes, I feel like I might be somewhat unique because I've been interested in politics since I was six and wanted the ability to vote. But so I guess, like, for some people it is different. There are some people who are more engaged. And for those who are more engaged, if their friends are able to pre-register to vote at 16 when they go to get their driver's license, as everyone at that age does as sort of a rite of passage, it seems reasonable to think that those people who are more engaged might inspire their friends to become more engaged as they do register to vote when they get their driver's license, and then when they get the verification that says, here's going to be your polling place, et cetera, which I can tell you I have that little notification framed in my dorm room, along with the picture of me filling out my registration form when it first happened. So that was a very satisfying experience for me. And, of course, I can only speak for me, but that's sort of my personal experience with that.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Hall. I wanted to add one other thing that maybe you may have missed, but this came from Youth in Government, where Mr. Thomas Cummings offered it as a bill, and it passed overwhelmingly. So it was something that already interested civic young people have looked at and think that it's valuable to them.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Carlson, I appreciate that, and I've been very involved since the very beginning of Youth in Government. I was one of the first participants of that. But I can tell you that the voting that I did, I was more concerned about my Saturday night hockey game than what I was doing there, I'm afraid. But it was a good program, and it did help me to spur my interest on in the future, even though I was a senior at that time at 17. So I appreciate that, but as my kids, and I think most kids, progress, there are many things I thought were important at the time that aren't quite as important. And this is a huge responsibility. And I actually think 17 is actually a good time in one sense because they don't forget about it. It's not like 16, okay, I did it. Well, did I sign up or didn't I sign up? I can't remember. Oh, well, I don't want to take the time to do it. I want them to get involved at the time they should. But if that's 16 and we decide that, I guess we have to go with that.
And again, a reminder, members, that this isn't saying that we're moving the voting age to 16. This is just registering them to vote so that when students are ready to vote or when young people are ready to vote, when they're eligible at 18, they'll already be registered.
Except for, Madam Chair, Representative Kahn's perennial bill on voting 16-year-olds.
I don't know if I haven't seen a Senate companion to that this session. Is there anyone, Senator Carlson, did I cut you off? Did you have something to say?
I just wanted to congratulate Madam Chair Senator Hall for how well that's prepared him.
Thank you.
Seeing no further discussion at this time, we'll lay over Senate File 2006 for possible inclusion in the omnibus elections bill.
As so amended.
Thank you, Senator Carlson. Senate File 660 is next on the agenda. Thank you to all the young people, again, who came to listen to this debate and to participate.
Did you get this on ordinance?
Senator Carlson, Senate File 660.
Madam Chair and members, I have Senate File 660, which is a bit of a different view of things. And what it addresses is some last-minute filings of for public office where there have been a little bit of abuses that you could say for people that come in at the last minute and attempt to file for office. And then there's some questions about their residency status and other issues like that. What it does is it provides for, it clarifies the method for a person to do an affidavit of residency or a petition for residency before that they file for office. Being joined here with Glenn Mills, the mayor of the city of Marina on St. Croix, where this type of thing has happened in the past. I'm going to defer to Mr. Mills, to Mayor Mills, to describe his particular situation.
Mayor Mills, welcome to the subcommittee.
Thank you, Senator Stephen. I've looked over Senate files.
Could you just please say your name, sir?
Oh, Glenn Mills, Mayor of Marina St. Croix. I've looked over Senate file 660, and you do have a copy of a letter from my clerk in your file, I suppose. First of all, I looked through it, and I don't have any basic objections to any of the changes you proposed to that part of the statute. I do kind of have to laugh because you say in lieu, you're going to waive the filing fee in lieu of having a petition. Well, in Marina St. Croix, we charge $2 to file for office. So otherwise, I'll move on to the clerk's letter. If you look at the clerk's letter, this issue came up in our last election. We had a gentleman who filed for office, and we weren't sure of his real name. And as we moved along through the process, my city clerk, who takes her job very seriously, you got to remember in a small town like Marine, my city clerk is also the zoning administrator. She's a treasurer, and she sells grave sites, too. So she's a busy woman, but running the elections is a very serious thing with her, very serious. And so when this gentleman came in and filed for office, she was on the phone to the mayor in a hurry. She said, I don't know what to do about this. I said, you better call the Secretary of State's office. And as you can see by the letter, she wasn't too happy with what she heard. And maybe this is something we could change the bill to at a later time. But basically, this gentleman filed for office and was supposed to be a resident within 30 days of the election. Well, of course, he wasn't. And at the election forum, he basically conceded to me that he hadn't moved to Marine and that he couldn't possibly win the election. And but it was too late. His name was on the ballot. Now, if I had gotten hit by a bus, and she did tell me to watch how I crossed the street from then on, that if he was elected, the city of Marina and St. Croix would have to pursue this in court to invalidate his election. So that's, I hope you read her letter good. I tried to get her to show up today, but of course, being the clerk in the city of Marina and St. Croix is a busy job. And I said, well, if there's another chance, you are going to come. And I will have to buy her lunch then, I suppose. Have any questions?
So, Mr. Mills, you're speaking in favor of Senate File 660?
Absolutely. And if
just to clarify that for the record.
And if it is determined that they want to amend it and make it more stringent in the areas that the clerk has pointed out, I'd be more than happy with that, too.
So I apologize, but I didn't read carefully because we got it so late. I didn't read carefully the city clerk's letter.
All
right. So that's partially where I'm getting tied up here. But I think
okay, she would like
looking it over quickly. One main concern is that there's only a 5% threshold of getting signatures instead of having it be a
higher absolutely.
Number
and if you notice how few a number we do vote, even though our voting percentage is usually up around 80% in the city of Marina, St. Croix. As little after the last election, as little as 28 signatures could be gathered, and then he could be on the ballot. And she was worried about that part. Now, that's already in law, and she would that would be one of her changes that she recommends. She would like to raise the percentage a little bit. I don't know. We were discussing that 5 to 7%, I guess.
So, counsel, could you please clarify what Mr. Mills is asking? Because it's my understanding that even if you get the signatures required as proposed under the
right.
language, there'd still be other requirements for the individual to file for office.
Madam Chair, that is correct, that you would still have to meet all of the other requirements, including the residency requirement, plus the petition. If you look at lines 2.26 of the bill, that's where it outlines the number. Sorry, it's starting on line 2.21. That's where it talks about the number of signatures that you must collect. And line 2.26 has that 5% figure. So if the concern is not with the other requirements, but is with the threshold, that could be increased to a higher number.
That's not what we are proposing to change.
No, the bill does not change the signature threshold right now.
Correct.
So, Mr. Mills, I think that your clerk has an issue with another section of the statute addressed in the bill that's before us.
Right.
Right.
It's still the same part of statute, but I'm just saying this is some of the things in her letter that she brought up besides the changes you had to this part of statute.
But the goal of the legislation, if I can speak for Senator Carlson, was that there perhaps needed to be clarification to what the other requirements are for someone to file for office.
Correct.
So that the legislation is attempting to clarify that or to...
Right, it is. But as she states also, that this affidavit they signed is essentially promising the information was true. If found otherwise, the local unit of government has to take that person to court again. And as she goes on to say in her letter, I found this explanation appalling. Now, you have to remember, this is my city clerk. She's very passionate about elections. And to find out that the city of Marin would have to pay for somebody who had broken their promise just really offended her. And this whole incident really took her back because she had never had to deal with this before.
Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair. I guess I'm not sure. Maybe perhaps counsel can help with the promising and the follow-up. Is that something that is done by the local police? Or I don't think it's campaign finance. I'm not sure who actually exercises that.
Ms. Stengel.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senators. I see Julie Struthers in the audience. She might be able to testify to this a little bit more. But essentially, if there is something wrong, it is up to the city or the whoever it is. In this case, it would have been the city that would have to go to court to get the name removed from the ballot, or if there's some other sort of error or omission, it would be going to court to get that corrected. And this bill doesn't provide any avenue, as it's written now, to have somebody removed from a ballot.
Ms. Struther, can you shed any light on this in terms of whether the Secretary's office has seen this as a problem before, been contacted by other units of government, or...
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Julie Struther with the Minnesota Secretary of State's office. What counsel said is true. Under current law, those filing an affidavit of candidacy, I think the language here, they said promise, but they have to swear when they sign the affidavit that they will reside in the district within 30 days. And the office does know that this is a problem that has occurred because as the city clerk knows, the ballots for absentee ballots go out 46 days before the general election. And so a challenge to someone's ability to be on the ballot due to residency
can only occur in that 30 days because the requirement under Minnesota law now, and my understanding and council can confirm under the Constitution, is that to be running for office at the local level, they only need to live in the district within 30 days. So it does present a challenge when someone doesn't meet the residency requirements, but the ballots are already out there for absentee balloting and have been printed, and there is no process in law for removal, and so it goes to court in an errors and omissions petition, and then it's up to the court to craft a remedy. It's not a common problem, but we certainly heard about this specific situation and recognize that it is a potential problem for other municipalities as well.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A little bit of history in regards to this. I remember one time when we had a candidate who filed for office who did not live in the U.S., and though it went to court, that person stayed on the ballot. The court is extremely reluctant to remove people from ballots. And even in situations sometimes where the residency, I mean, I don't know how much more obvious it could have been they lived outside the state, but it was a congressional, federal one, so a little different laws, rules apply on that kind of a federal situation. And here we are completely within the state of Minnesota, but even still, the courts are very, very, very reluctant to do so. And the 30 days is always hard because of the absentee ballots, but you've actually got two issues going on here, which just I didn't see an answer to, and that was the person's name that he wanted to file under, and I was just curious as to whatever happened there. But I'm not confident that putting on, at least as far as I've read this language, that everybody, you know, you have one situation and a problem here, right? And this person, I'm guessing, did not win anyway in I know the withdrawing is moot because they're still on the ballot, but they didn't win. And so the voters seem to have done a pretty good job of seeing through this sort of a thing and took care of it on their own. But putting in a petition and a residency petition and another thing like this for maybe somebody who is not, I don't know that it would have kept your person mm-hmm. off anyway. And I don't know that the burden to other people would even hold in regards to adding another requirement to get on the ballot, which is another petition like this, and going through all of that. So I just have my concerns about it. That plus maybe you could address the name issue and what happened there.
Well, what happened was,
Mr. Mills,
as you can, Madam Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, as you can read in the letter, he presented with a name that wasn't even known in the community. I guess that's legal under state law. If it's known under the community, you can use that name. But he claimed that because of his religious affiliation, that group, that's where his name was known. And also, I think he used a Native American twist in there, too. Anyway, so when she questioned this, he signed the affidavit, and again, it's a promise. And she did research on it more and found out that most everybody called him by Michael Arndt, not by the other name he used. But again, he signed the affidavit and even put a website on there that was fictitious too.
Okay, Madam Chair, my question though more specifically is what name did he put on the ballot then?
He did put on the Michael A. McIntosh.
Okay. There is a court case precedent where a name situation did go to court, and the court did disallow a name being used on the ballot, just a matter of information for you.
Okay.
But again, it does, and it was, I know you're a city government, and so the cost of some of those, but I'm just not confident that this bill solves it for you, though I sympathize with the pain of your situation. But once again, the voters did see through this, which is ultimately one of the best things. But I think maybe a little more work on this and thinking through this. I'm just not confident that this will do what you want it to do.
Well, again, I was asked to testify.
You may still have to go to court.
I'm sorry. Can we just go through me? Otherwise, it gets a little So okay. Mayor Mills.
Okay. I'm sorry. Madam Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, I would be glad to work on this with the powers that be. In fact, I will, my city clerk also stated that she would be happy to work on this. So if you want to lay this over, or if Senator Carlson would like to lay it over, we could do that too.
The bill is going to be laid over for possible inclusion.
And we could make changes to it.
If there is language that you're not comfortable with already, either based on this conversation or otherwise, I'll leave it up to Senator Carlson on what he wants to do. But I think that it's important to point out that some of the, if you look at the language that's before us, there isn't anything that is modifying the number of signatures that are required. For instance, this is establishing a residency petition in place of the filing fee, and then establishing different thresholds that a candidate has to meet to be a candidate on a ballot. So I think in some way we need to step away from the particular case of what happened in Marine on the St. Croix to see if this is good policy for the state to adopt separate from this particular instance. I know that there was similar language in that Senator Nenow, I was told, had a similar bill previously, and I haven't talked to him about this proposal, but Senator Carlson, perhaps before the bill comes back in the full omnibus bill, you could check in with Senator Nenow and compare your language to what he had and see if what insights he might be able to have. And Ms. Strother, we haven't asked your office if you I haven't put you on the spot by asking if you think that this language works or it's a good idea for an overall application, but if you want to make any comments as to the overall bill, we would welcome your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we recognize that this is a problem and that this has come up before. I know that this was a bill that I believe was carried in the House by Representative Johnson dealing with another issue that's happened in his district. The office doesn't have a position on the exact form of the solution, but has looked at the language, and this would be one way of maybe not solving all the problems, but would move closer to addressing the issue. The real solution would require something like a constitutional amendment if the concern is that 30 days. But this is something that would at least move towards addressing the issue, even if it wouldn't, as the clerk said, be a fix in every situation.
Is there anybody else in the audience who wishes to testify on the bill in front of us, Senate File 660? So, Senator Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair. I guess the name issue here is a bit of a surprise to me, and I think maybe what we need to do is, like you say, take a step back. I will talk to Senator Nenow to see what his bill looked like. I was under the understanding that it was the basic the affidavit and the number of days was the only issue. But I think if we have an issue with the names not aligning with what the person is known as, I think that's another issue.
Senator Carlson, perhaps counsel can weigh in here or point us to the section of statute that references how a candidate's name appears on a ballot, but that is not really addressed in this Senate file, and it is addressed in another area of statute. So we should kind of put that aside, except Ms. Stengel, perhaps you could direct us to where that is or to follow up with Senator Carlson afterwards.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I will follow up with Senator Carlson and anybody else that's interested on the specific sites, but there are several sections in Chapter 204B that talk about how a name must be listed as your common name. You can't use a name that would influence. There's limitations on what party names you can use. So I will find those specific sites and forward those to the Senator.
Okay, thank you. So at this time, we'll lay over Senate File 660. Thank you, Senator Carlson.
Thank you.
And Mr. Mills.
Thank you, Senator Chairman.
So the final bill that's before us is Senator Eakin's bill. Senator Eakin, Senate File 492.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 492 is a redistricting bill. It's a bill that would remove some of the authority or some of the responsibility for redistricting from the legislature and create a panel of retired judges. The legislature and under redistrict, it would be a redistricting commission. It would consist of five retired judges. Four of them would be appointed by legislative leaders, one by the minority leader of the House, one by the minority leader of the Senate, and one by the Speaker of the House, and one by the majority leader of the Senate. And the four judges then would appoint a fifth member. And these, again, these retired judges then would be responsible for drawing up the new district lines for the next redistricting. There are five states that currently utilize this form of redistricting commissions. They are the states of Iowa, New York, Ohio, Maine, and Rhode Island. Nine other states use some form of redistricting commission. That includes Connecticut, Indiana, Hawaii, Idaho, Montana, New Jersey, California, and Arizona. But unlike the legislation proposed here, the other forms of commissions used by the other states do not allow for legislative approval of the plan. Now, this is actually in court right now. We have not gone as far in this legislation of actually completely removing the legislature from this responsibility. Because there is a constitutional question whether the United States Supreme Court does allow for the legislature to, I guess, turn its responsibility over to another entity completely. And that's what the court case is going to determine in the case of these other states which have done that. I think it's this section sets the redistricting, Section 1 sets the redistricting principles that are required or the guided by state and federal constitutional requirements and also requirements of the Voting Rights Act. And Section 2 is the part of the bill that actually creates the redistricting commission. I already mentioned how they would be selected. They would submit a redistricting plan, and the first plan would be submitted to the legislature, and the legislature could either accept or reject the plan, and if they reject it, the redistricting commission then would have to submit a second plan within 2 weeks after the rejection of the first plan. Either that or if the legislature adjourns before the 2 weeks is up, it would have to be at the beginning of the next legislative session. The legislature then would have an opportunity to either accept or reject the second plan. And by the way, the first plan could not be modified by the legislature. It's just a simple acceptance or rejection of the plan. The same thing is true with the second plan. The legislature can either accept or reject. If it's rejected again, the commission would make another recommendation or would submit another plan to the legislature, a third one. And this third plan could be modified by the legislature. So the legislature is not completely removed, but the commission would have the responsibility of at least initiating the initial or, I guess, proposing the initial plans for redistricting. And one of the reasons this is done, I guess, quite frankly, I believe that there is a conflict of interest in us drawing our own district lines. It's obvious that we do have a direct benefit in the outcome of how those lines are drawn. And there are concerns about whatever party may be in control at the time, if one party's in control of all three branches of government, that those lines could be drawn to the benefit of one party over the other. And that's not what redistricting is meant to do. Redistricting is meant to make sure that we have an equal number of people in each district and hopefully draw districts that do have competitive districts and that are competitive in nature and, again, do not favor or benefit one side over the other. It should be an unbiased, objective group of individuals who are making these decisions, not those who bear a direct or who will have a direct benefit in the outcome. And I do have here to testify as well the Secretary of State, Steve Simon.
Welcome back, Secretary Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I appreciate the opportunity. I think this is an important piece of legislation, and I start with the principle, as many others have repeated before me, that voters should choose their elected officials, not the other way around. And the problem with redistricting is it looks a lot like the other way around, like it's elected officials choosing their voters. Now, some might ask, why are we doing this in 2015? The last census was 5 years ago. The next one is 5 years from now. I would argue this is exactly the time to have this discussion because the closer we get to 2020, which is the election that will elect the map makers in this body and in the House of Representatives, the closer we get to that date, the more likely this process will be politicized, the more likely it is that people on both sides of the aisle will be thinking to themselves, or maybe even out loud, maybe my party will run the table in 2020. Maybe my party will control the House, the Senate, and the governorship, and maybe my party can draw its dream map. It's a natural inclination. Having been a legislator, I experienced that in the last census cycle, and I think both parties' expectations were upended by the 2010 election. Presumably, there were some Democrats who thought, having controlled at the time the House and Senate, that they could win the governorship. Well, they lost the House and Senate, but they gained the governorship. And conversely, there were maybe some Republicans going into 2010 who, given the political climate that year, thought, well, the Republicans controlled the governorship. They'll take over the House and Senate. They did half of that. They took over the House and Senate, but not the governorship. So the other, I think, practical point beyond just good government reasons is that those who have been around here a lot longer than I have and most of in this room have say that decade after decade, it's a tremendous it takes a tremendous amount of time and resources to do redistricting here in the legislature, and it almost always and in modern times, since 1960, every year has ended up in the courts. And the courts either substantially or even more than substantially, sometimes completely, end up drawing the maps anyway. So the idea of this bill, I think, is to acknowledge that fact that the legislature almost never by itself ends up drawing the map. It ends up in a partisan stalemate anyway. And the experience of these other states has been quite positive. It's made districts that are more fair, in some cases more competitive, and it has, as Senator Eakin and others said, removed some of that conflict of interest. And I think Senator Eakin's bill has the advantage of a really workable, practical solution here where the legislature still maintains ultimate control, either with an up-and-down vote in the first two instances or in the final instance actually doing the map-making, but it at least recognizes that maybe in the first instance, five retired judges, two chosen by Democrats, two by Republicans, and the fifth chosen by the four retired judges, that they would at least in the first instance draw the initial map and avoid some of the political problems. So, Madam Chair and Senators, thank you for allowing me to testify on this bill. I think it's a good step forward and a good conversation to have at this time.
Mr. Secretary or Senator Eakin, why retired judges? Why not currently serving judges?
Madam Chair and members, my understanding is that in most states where this has been tried, they've done it with retired judges. But, you know, my personal view is there's nothing particularly sacred about it being retired judges. But I know that's been the norm in the other states where they've done this. I'm guessing and only speculating that that might just be a function of their time, that current judges might have crowded dockets and not be able to dedicate the time. But I'm only speculating.
Other discussion. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question I have for you is, there are some redistricting principles that are in this legislation. Are these redistricting principles the same as current law?
Senator Eakin.
Madam Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, yes, they are. So it's a codification, really, of what current practice is in those regard. In that regard.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Then I'm reading through this, and it all sounds really good. But again, having been around for a few of these and the whole experience, and I look at this and then I see that they submit a plan to the legislature. If that's rejected, they go to a second plan. That's rejected. They go to a third one. And then the commission expires when both legislative congressional redistrict plans have been enacted into law or adopted by court order or upon adjournment sine die. So I look at this and just kind of knowing sometimes how these things go, I look at this and say, well, the motivation and the intention is good and worthy, and I've looked at them before. I see this maybe only accumulating more time, more expense, more effort, and it's still going to the court. Much less the fact that the whole idea of delegating, I think the legislature ought to be really careful about ceding their authority as the legislature. I think we have so much of that already where we're moving over into doing that, and that we are the legislative body and we should not just cede that over, and especially when in something like this it is probably more likely going to come out to the court anyway. The court hasn't really actually done too bad on what they do. There's the input and some of those things. So whatever may be, that are just kind of my comments in regards to this.
Oh, Madam Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, as far as the expense of time, legislative time would be expended, a lot of it, and wastefully so, in my view, if it's not going to result in a final product. And that happens most of the time because usually no one party has complete control of all three branches of the House, Senate, and the governor's office. And if that's the case, I think it really makes sense in that situation that we have something of this nature established, which will actually result in an end product probably in the end, instead of having a lot of time spent in the legislature debating and putting together these maps. Why not from the very beginning set up an independent, objective group panel that's going to draw up a map that's much more likely to be adopted in the end and much more likely to be, have districts that are more competitive, districts that are less biased, in how they're being drawn up. And also, I think it's important to note that even if it is a government that's controlled by the same three branches, I think this panel would submit a plan that would in many cases be hard not to adopt if it's a very objective, balanced map of districts that's drawn up.
Secretary Simon.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I neglected to mention one thing in my testimony, which I should have mentioned at the outset, and that is the other support for this legislation. This legislation actually grew out of a proposal made a number of years ago by a really star-studded group, bipartisan, really tripartisan group, of Minnesotans. Among them were former Vice President Walter Mondale, former Governor Al Quie, former Congressman Tim Penny, former House Speaker Steve Swigum, and former Minnesota Chief Justice Kathleen Blatz. I reached out to all of them before this hearing, was able to speak directly with three of them. And the following three, Al Quie, former governor, Tim Penny, former congressman, and Steve Swigum, former House Speaker, all said they were unable to be here today. They will be signing a letter later, just indicating and repeating their support for this legislation, but they hope in subsequent hearings, either here or in the House, to be able to either testify or sign a letter. But all three told me that I was it was fine to use their name at this hearing and say that they are strong supporters of the legislation.
Thank you. Senator Eakin, I was just asking counsel, because I don't really understand. Right now, under current law, a plan has to be approved by the legislature and then signed into law by the governor. It looks like under your proposal, the plan is submitted to the legislature for rejection or adoption, but what's the governor's role in your proposal?
Madam Chair, I believe that the governor's role is still to sign the bill at the end of it.
So the plan is submitted to the legislature, to both bodies. They pass it just like a regular bill,
right,
and it has to be signed into law.
Yes, Madam Chair. It just follows the same process once it's submitted to the legislature. that it does now.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Eakin, during that particular time, would the House and Senate be permitted to amend the plan of the panel that it would be created?
And Madam Chair, Senator. And Senator Limmer, the first two plans cannot be modified. They can only be accepted or rejected. And then if they're rejected, there's 2 weeks for them to submit another plan. And that third plan, if the legislature rejects the second plan, there's 2 weeks for them to submit a third plan, and that plan can be modified by the legislature at that point.
So, Madam Chair, what I can tell is that the legislature still is not removed from the process. That could be good or bad, depending on how the bill is created by the panel, this independent panel. It still could be subject to challenge in a court. So what are we really accomplishing by going through a panel?
Senator Eakin.
And if a court could ultimately decide it again anyway.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, that is a possibility, but I think it's much less likely under this plan. I think it's much more likely that you're going to have a good plan that is objective, that's going to be adopted before it gets to that stage of having to go through the court system. And I think that in the end saves some time if that's the outcome. Ultimately, yes, the legislature does still retain ultimate control if they go through three plans and still reject it and then modify it. But I think that's very unlikely to occur. If I had my preference, I would prefer that the commission have complete control. But we've decided that we're just going to go as far as we know we can right now, because there's still the constitutional question as to whether we can give up that power completely. And that is in the courts right now. A Supreme Court decision will be coming forward that will confirm whether or not we can give up that power. But we're going to go as far as we can that we know we can at this point in time.
Doesn't say that.
I'm sure the only comment I may have, I've been around a long time, and this might be my fourth presence around a redistrict. Well, let's hope it's not the fourth one, but at least three times that we've considered and rewritten our reapportionment maps. And I think every one of them that I've been witnessing has all ended up in the courts. And so I think that no matter who draws the lines, I think it's just the nature of the beast. It's going to end up in courts because it's such a competitive environment that if any one political party, or for that matter, one citizen, thinks that it's an unfair map and can argue that in a court, the court will get it and they'll redraw it anyway. And quite honestly, I'm almost to the point that the courts are better map drawers than the legislature is. So in the last nearly 30 years, it seems like the courts, like I say, are better map drawers than we are, and maybe they should just be the panel ultimately and we just not do anything and just believe that we'll send it there, and there's out of 5 million people, there'll be at least one that'll say it's unfair for some reason, and it'll end up there one way or the other. I'm not sure if the panel independently drawing the map will bring it to any better conclusion, and that it'll still go to the courts. I thank you for trying to reinvent the wheel, though.
Senator Eakin.
And Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, I'm hopeful that this won't result in it going to the courts. That's really the ultimate objective here, is to prevent it from going through this whole process of the legislature doing the maps and then having the courts decide anyway. Why not have a panel of retired judges from the very beginning? And I understand what you're saying, that if the legislature doesn't accept, we could end up going through this the same process again at going to the courts. But the hope is that it would circumvent that process and result in an objective map drawing from the very start.
Senator Eakin, just looking at your little language, I think that you should continue to look at my question earlier, where, say, for example, there's a Republican legislature, both bodies, and a Democratic governor. The way I read it, if the legislature, if the panel of retired judges submits a plan and the legislature enacts it, or the legislature approves it, it says, then it would become the new plan. Well, I guess it does say that the plans may be enacted or rejected. So the word enacted may mean that the governor needs to give his sign the bill into law or not, his signature. Is that your understanding too, just to be real clear?
Madam Chair, that was my reading of it.
Because it just keeps talking in the language about the legislature enacting or rejecting the plan. And I think it's pretty unclear. Like, what if both bodies of the legislature rejected a plan, then it would be rejected and go back. But what if they approved or enacted a plan and then the governor rejected it? I just don't think it's really that clear.
And Madam Chair, I'm certainly open to amendment to put language in to make it clear that it would go to the governor for signature.
Well, Senator Eakin, I don't know if council is prepared to. No. Perhaps we could lay this bill over for today, and then we can work on the language again before. My intention with this, just to be clear, was to take a vote on it and to send it to the full Rules Committee. But I would be more comfortable doing that after we kind of work out these questions with the language. So if you're okay with that, Senator Eakin, we can lay Senate File 492 over with the intention that we'll bring it back up for a vote at our next committee hearing.
Madam Chair, I would so move.
Thank you. So seeing no more business before the committee is adjourned.
Hey, Warren.
Gotcha.